Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Monday the 22nd of July of the year 2013. And on a June afternoon, Joe Partis will be your host, following a special program featuring the poetry of Emily Wall. Lori Yova will be giving us the Monday night's Kia dance class. Get a visitor from Kim Camp, will feature writers Almanac Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with patchy fog later on, low temperatures around 51 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain, high temperatures on 63 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain and high temperatures 64 degrees. Thursday night through Friday night, forecast mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain.
Welcome to Telling Tales, a program devoted to the spoken word. I'm Ms. G. Today, poet Emily Wall, assistant professor of English at the University of Alaska Southeast, reads selections from her book, Live Aboard, published by Salmon Poetry, and offers thoughts on poetry as an art form. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the words of poet Emily Wall.
I started writing poetry when I was 14 and bored in a math class, and I've been writing ever since. But I got serious about it when I was an undergrad at Colby College and studying poetry with the poet Iris Sadoff. The best poems, I think, come from writers who I feel like are expressing things that I have thought but not thought of as a thought yet, if that makes sense. Particularly poems by like Mary Oliver or Iris Sadoff, they'll say something and as I read it, I think that's exactly how I feel or that's exactly what that experience is like. So it gives voice to things that we maybe haven't given voice to ourselves before. When I come into a classroom and see my students for the first time, the first thing I tell them is that this is a place to experiment, to play. This is not a place where we're trying to impress each other or impress ourselves. This is a learning place, and that really helps us. It frees us up to make mistakes, to experiment, to take advice from each other, and that's really important in the classroom. Is poetry an academic thing or an emotional thing? I don't really see those as diametrically opposed, I guess. It's both. For me, it's an academic thing because it's my job, and I believe that there's a lot of good poetry that comes out of academic thinking about it and writing about it. But poetry has to be come from a region very close to the heart or it's not going to be anything worth reading. I have no patience for poems that are academic exercises or all about language or showing off. Poetry needs to come from somewhere inside of us to mean anything. The poems I'm going to be reading are from my book titled Live Aboard, which came out with the Irish Press, Salmon Poetry. And these poems were written while I was living aboard my Tana 37 sailboat down in Vancouver. I lived aboard for 4 years and sailed and cruised around the coast of British Columbia and Washington. And the poems really deal with issues of living aboard, living with the natural world, living in those kinds of communities. This poem is called Saturday Morning. Sometimes we just want to cut our bodies away from the dock, shake out our aching sails, close our eyes, hands on the wheel, and yes, yes, in wind. It doesn't matter if we go upriver or down, if we see seals or silver salmon, if we get lost in the back eddies, if we get sung out to sea. Every nerve in our necks thrums down our spines until even our cramped hands begin to hum. Threaten to break into pale sea stars, indigo blossoms. This next poem is called Live Aboard. Multiple poems in the collection are called Live Aboard as I'm exploring different cycles and different themes in the book, issues of faith, issues of living in the community, living in the natural world. And this one is about living on the dock. We lived in a marina called Shelter Island Marina on the Fraser River, and it was an incredibly interesting community to live in, sort of like being back in college in a dorm. We all shared a mail room and a pub at the top of the dock and bathrooms, and so we got to know each other really well. And on our dock, there was a big flat space where we created a community garden. We used to hang out there together and have parties and stuff. And so this poem is about that dock. Live Aboard. The most beautiful garden in the world is a dock garden. At the foot of the ramp on B Dock, Cheryl has created a utopia of potted plants. Tendrils climb the power pole. Vines cover the sign that warns us of electric current. There are hanging plants on all the pilings that go up and down and up again. She waters at high tide when the hanging pots are waist high. There are cherry tomatoes, and we help ourselves as we pass on the way to our boats, sweetness bursting on our tongues as we walk down the wooden dock. Almost all of us have small gardens, too. A few pots of straw flowers or pansies. Tony, living in his float home, has flowers that attract hummingbirds. A mallard pair uses a pot of petunias on Lorna's dock as a nest. Each evening we gather around to admire the 5 creamy eggs. And when they hatch, the ducks are born right into the soil and pop out of the plant, one by one, as we watch. Even the woman on the other Tayana, who we met in Montague Harbor, who is heading out for a cruise around the world, has an herb garden in tiny pots attached to her cockpit rail. She dug up her favorite plants from their sprawling house and is taking them with her despite her husband's irritation. The boat is offshore ready, outfitted with $10,000 of electronics. Hull and deck are perfect, but she cannot give up a small patch of soil with her thyme and mint and sage. Even though we live on water, we all keep a small patch of earth near us and dig our fingers into it each evening, smelling the soil on our hands, catching it under our nails before we step on board to sleep on nothing more substantial than water in a fast river current. This next poem is for Joni, who lived a few boats from us on the dock and drowned in the second year that we lived there. And it's called Sleeping in Sharon's Wake. The Sharon in the title refers to the Sharon of the River Styx. Sleeping in Sharon's Wake. Some things always wake us. A tug coming in at 3 a.m., prop boiling the water like a boat crossing the Styx, our own boat slamming the dock in the wake. I open my eyes and see powerful sodium lights shining into the hatch over my head. Hear shouts as the tug fights the current and a man leaps to the dock to get a wrap around a cleat. And other things don't wake us. Joni, eating at the pub on steak and prawn night, drinking her usual bottle of wine, slips coming down the dock, slips into the cool green river next to her own boat, which must have rocked a little in the wake of her body. What are the secret weapons of poetry? I think the secret weapons are many. For me, I use a couple things in particular. I think narrative is really important for poetry, telling stories. A lot of times I think we think that you're either a storyteller or a poet, and that's not true. Poems can tell stories. And I also think metaphor is incredibly powerful. It's a form of creation and transformation. To compare two things that are unlike creates a new third thing, and that's, in my mind, a true act of creation. Not simply using images or language to describe something, but to make something wholly new. And I think the best metaphors are able to create an idea of how we're feeling. It sort of puts words to something that's hard to name, that's hard to identify, by using an image. When I lived in Vancouver, I lived in a marina that was on the Fraser River. The Fraser River is actually an estuary. The Strait of Georgia tides up into the river. Because of that, the Fraser River Delta is a major habitat for migratory birds. Several million shorebirds pass over this estuary annually, and tens of thousands remain every winter. A lot of the poems in this book explore the intimacy of living in such close proximity to these birds. This is called Permission. There are 3 nesting pairs of geese on the river this spring. Last night we watched them swimming for the island. One pair had 7 goslings strung out like pearls between the clasps of them. A second pair had 1 between them, their shadow a small mountain range. The final pair had none. They swam to the island with the others as if teaching young geese to swim. Their loss was strung in space across river water, and everyone on the dock discussed the taking of goslings by the pair of eagles who hunt here all year. I know this is right, this is good. The eagles do not need our permission to eat. But I see now that I am too much in the house of the mind to listen to the unpermissioned needs of the body. How will I change enough to celebrate the full bellies of wild eagles? This next poem is a modified extended haiku. The idea with an extended haiku poem is that each stanza exists on its own as a standalone haiku, but together they build a larger picture. This one has been modified that I've created two stanzas that are haikus and then a couplet that follows that, and I've done that three times in the poem. And this is about a great blue heron. Great blue haiku. Here you come. I love your swinging hips wide as a woman's feathered thighs. But landing, you shrug your shining shoulders like an absent-minded priest. Could this really be you, blue Madonna of the river? You begin fishing, stepping to the hunger of your hallowed belly, stalking the rich weeds in a trance, a prayer we have all memorized. But now you open your wings, fling water like coins, careless. Who are you? We read the river daily, we learn the catechism of you, holy bird, blue shape of the soul, a door opening for us. But now you rise with a shriek, a cry from some other world, where beauty cannot be transcribed onto our hearts as religious texts, where memorizing the verse of your feeding dance cannot feed our own flightless desires. What's left? The empty altar of grass. Do I think poems are better read out loud or read to themselves? I think both is excellent, actually. They're different experiences. I think when you're sitting alone in your armchair reading a poem, you have a very intimate connection to that poem. You hear it in your head, you have your own images, and I think you create a relationship with that poem, and it becomes yours in that way. But I also love hearing poets read, and oftentimes the poem will change for me when I hear a poet read. They'll emphasize certain things, they will conjure up images I may not have seen before. An introduction to a poem can change the way we understand a poem. So I really love both. I like reading it myself first, and then I love hearing poets read their work. We spend a lot of time talking about poetry in class. My students are great for helping me understand and think about poetry. They really challenge me and challenge the way that I think about the craft. This poem explores the recent phenomenon of teenagers setting off to break world records sailing. Tanya Abey did it first when she was in her early 20s. She sailed solo around the world in a 21-foot boat. And this past year, a teenager from New Zealand named Jessica Watson became the youngest person to sail unassisted around the world. She was 16 when she completed her circumnavigation. So this poem is written for her. Crossing Desire. Perhaps you are a fool. Or maybe, like an Arctic tern, it's all about long distances for you. Perhaps you have unloving parents, as everyone says. Or maybe you are the albatross, simply able and willing to go without stopping. I hope for your sake it's not about the record, the youngest to circumnavigate. I think you'll write a book about how you found yourself out on the wide waters, the last frontier of our collective minds. But I imagine, like Tanya Abey, you'll be in all the magazines, and you and your racing boat will become the images of our armchair desires for a while. And then there's divorce, lost children, a wandering in the desert for many years, because where else is there to go now? I hope that won't be true. I hope you'll be able to find another frontier or two, another ocean to cross, and you'll be able to live the years by planning and dreaming as we are meant to do. One of the cycles in this book is what I call the Eve poems, and I'm referring to the biblical Eve here, that first woman, the only woman who lived in the Garden of Eden. And these poems explore that first woman's relationship to the natural world, and they also tie into the concept that we have of Eden, that sort of first lost garden. Sailors in particular, I think, are a little obsessed with Eden because we're always looking for that perfect gunghole, the perfect marina, the perfect harbor that no one else is in. It's kind of this obsession of returning to that first place. Eve becoming. As I flip through the Sibley guide, looking up a duck who arrives with a splash, I wonder about Eve. Did she learn from Adam the name Northern Pintail? Was she taking notes as he said mallard, blackbird? Or did the birds tell her, as Adam checked them off his life list, winging over her head, look at me, my loose bones of flight, their names just opening on the wet tongue of her heart, and suddenly she knew them like she knew everything. This is a goose. This quiet place by the river Tigris is mine, and my name is Eve. Recognize me. Eve sailing. When she wakes, Beside her cupped palm is a leaf, a green dory with ribs, a stem, a rudder. It's rocking in the soft morning wind. Just beyond is a white feather, a bit of down from a northern gannet who crosses the ocean in just 5 days. A white sail bellied, ready. Eve closes her eyes and slippers her body into this cupped, rocking space, the closest she'll ever come to a womb. She holds the sides, presses her face to the wind, and feels her body lift across the water, that pull and tug of body, boat, wind, desire. If she doesn't open her eyes, she could sail all the way across Eden. If she doesn't open her eyes, she could imagine a mother for herself. Imagine sailing between two warm thighs and out into the light of a world where she is not the only woman, where she is not the only one who doesn't have the power to create. Eve in Eden. It must have taken a long time, this work of naming. Every day animals must have passed through your garden. A flash of blue during dinner and a reminder that work is to be done. Did you sit back on your hands, legs out, while Adam said, peacock, lemur, horned toad? Did you think of asking God as he walked in the garden with you that evening about naming a few yourself? Did you try out names on your tongue, rolling delicious vowels in your mouth? Did you hear Adam say leopard and think, what a prosaic name that was? That surely you could have done better. Names. Violet-crowned, Berylin, Broad-tailed, Cinnamon, Caliope. Hummingbird names unfurl on the tongue like a curl of butter, melting into the body's memory of hunger and flight, and the name we carried like feathers before we arrived in this world and weighted ourselves with solid bones, classified as accountant, homeowner, parent, minivan, soccer practice, diabetes, overweight, suburbia. Remember being ruby-throated? I almost do.
You're listening to Telling Tales, today featuring poet Emily Wall, reading selections from her book, Live Aboard.
When we lived in Vancouver, we spent summers cruising the Washington and BC coasts, and we particularly loved the Gulf Islands and Desolation Sound. The next two poems deal with cruising in Desolation Sound. Captain Vancouver named this amazing place Desolation because it was remote and forbidding. And I love the irony of that name because it's this beautiful, warm spot. The water there is incredibly warm, and it has all of this marine life. And it's a really popular cruising spot. Hundreds of boats go there every summer. It's interesting how our ideas of desolation and Eden change over the centuries. Grace Harbor, Desolation Sound. When we wake the next morning and look over the side to check the anchor, jellies, jellies, jellies. The water around us is a thick carpet of moon jellies, each little orb pulsing, rising and falling in the tide swell. Even though we know better, we can't help stretching out our hands, reaching down. Who could resist touching the moon if it came down in its thousand little bodies and surrounded us? Sometimes we need to be chosen. Sometimes we need for belief to be out of our hands. This next poem is about the only community in Desolation Sound. It's called Refuge Cove, and it's basically laundry facilities and a shower and a little store, but it's a meeting place for everybody there. This poem is also a ghazal, which is an ancient Persian form. I've been experimenting with different forms in this book. I have a couple sestinas, some extended haiku, and this ghazal. So in this form, it's composed of a number of couplets, and each couplet has to completely stand alone. It can't connect to the one before or after it. But together they have to build the whole poem. The only connection between them is that the last word of each couplet has to be the exact same word. In this one I've used the word boat. Ghazal for Refuge Cove. A long, splintered dock, some cleats on floats, holding fast our lines three deep, dinghies, yachts, boats. Shower floor, rich with steam and swirls of hair, relief. Skin breathing again, thighs, gleaming boats. When you stern tide, do you loop back around? thick beard, canvas shoes, rich smell of mildew on his liveaboard boat. Otters, under rotting boards, grind crab shells in their teeth, ravenous, littering the water with sharp shells of boat. Outside the harbor, wind beats the strait. Water sleeves up into spray. Long schooners of salt coat the decks of entering boats. We knock fresh beers, welcome new arrivals. Store closes at 6. Long sun slanting through harbor entrance, making new the battered boats. Tinker with the depth sounder. Red numbers flash as tide rises, then falls. New tendrils of algae caress the keel, backbone of boat. Mandolin music, three boats over and an accordion joins in. We sip chilled wine, raise our glasses when they walk by our reeling boats. Tide fast, deep sleep, no one on watch tonight, except the moon floating on the thousand wavelets, traveling the length of this sweet, temporary home. The next few poems explore our relationship to God and how we try to find our footing in this whole idea of faith, how we live on the water, how we live in our communities with the natural world, and how we live with our belief systems. Communion. In November, deep storms come, rising the river into sheets of white, vestments lifting in wind. The boat heels over. I wake, roll out of my berth, walk quietly into the galley, and light the stove. It takes a while. Alcohol, kerosene, just the right amount of knob turning and breath holding. It feels a little like morning matins, this ritual. I put on the old percolator, and the singing gurgle of the pot is a quiet chorus starting up. Nobody makes coffee this way anymore. I stand and watch, make sure the pot doesn't slide off the stove in a fresh gust of wind. Out the porthole I see tangled waves, the ruffled feathers of a passing duck. Inside, the darkness smells rich as incense. I pour coffee into a silver thermos, wrap myself in an old quilt, and ease up on deck, where I can see our whole stretch of river, grasses bowing deeply. I touch the coffee to my lips. Say amen. This is the real communion of the heart. Here on the wild river, living this ritual day after day, my mouth and hands at the center of the way I can know God. Navigating faith. If heaven was in the North Country, the voice of God calling us home would be Canada geese, wild arrows showing us the way. Reminding us as they pass over our working bodies that this is where we too will go. Now in a heavy rain, as they pass above us, singing their hymn of holy highways, we look up, watch the wake of their bodies cutting through thick clouds, and the clear direction they offer us this morning makes it easy. Of course I'll follow them, up into the north mountains of mist and spruce, up to a God who loves our heavy, feathered bodies. Eve, finally. For a while, perfection was easy. We seemed to think it was our due, this sweetness, this garden, where every morning I would walk, brushing my hands along the feathery heads of wild grass to relieve them of their dew. This was the way I washed my hands every morning, baptizing each finger awake. But then, walking in the evenings with Adam and Yahweh, I began to feel something, gathering, coming. I began to see the shadows and the fallen grasses. Sometimes I walked behind them, listened to the rumble of their talk, and it sounded like thunder just beyond the next hill. I began to look for lightning. For what perfection can last forever? I know now we're not made to live in an unspoiled world. I can't imagine heaven. All I want is to hold Abel in my arms, and for a glimpse again of the wild grasses, sweetly wet and new. This poem tells the story of a couple we met while we were out cruising. One of the real pleasures of cruising is meeting other cruisers and exchanging stories and information. This is especially sweet if you have similar boats. we pulled into this little marina in the Gulf Islands, and this couple had the exact same boat we had, so we're pretty excited to talk to each other. Sailing to Seventh Heaven. We drop the hook in Montague Harbor, this sweet corner of the Gulf Islands, pop open two beers, and look around, taking stock of the other boats. And there is another Tejana exactly like ours, only with a blue hull and newer sails. Within minutes, a dinghy rushes over from their boat to ours. The skipper invites us over to see his boat, to meet his wife, to see how he's outfitted for an ocean crossing. They just retired, just finished refitting, and are headed out this week for a life beyond. We dinghy to their beautiful boat and find ourselves in awe of the work they have done. Everything on our life list already finished on their gleaming yacht. His wife makes us tea and shows me the stacked linens, the small herb garden she is growing in pots hanging on the cockpit rail. He shows Corey the electronic cockpit, the new diesel engine. Then she shows me the small urn containing her cat's remains. She died the week we packed up, and I just couldn't leave her behind, she tells me, and starts to cry. This is all his idea. He sold our house. I touch her arm, look at her perfect boat, listen to her cry about her grandchildren. Down in the stern, he shows Corey his new navigation system, his new weather station. He's prepared for anything. He's been saving his entire life for this. The next day, they visit our boat, and as I show her the way I've organized the lockers, our cat wanders in, and she bursts into tears, holds and holds the cat. Please let me take her, she begs, this woman I've met yesterday. She strokes and strokes Tio's head. I'm sorry, I say, I'm sorry. We sit on the floor of the boat, and I hold her hand, this woman about to cross an ocean with a man she calls him. I think they will make it to Hawaii, and she'll leave him, and he'll have to sell the boat, one of hundreds who have done this, who have spent years building their dream, and then abandon it in paradise, return to the suburbs without anything to plan for, to dream about. And every visit from a grandchild will have to be perfect. Every flower she grows will have to be worth thousands of dollars, a lifetime of hopes and wishes. Corey and I watch them dinghy back to their boat, he facing forward, she facing back, their bodies soon lost in the blinding light of the setting sun. When we were living in Vancouver, we would cruise every summer all around the coast, and at the end of the summer, we would go back to the Gulf Islands and spend a couple nights there before we crossed the strait and returned back to the city and our work there. I'm fascinated by the idea of returning, that most of us find some way to escape from the lives we've chosen and presumably want to live, and then we escape into these places that for us are a way of escaping from our lives. And they're often natural places, places in the natural world that we connect with. Leaving the islands. I want to slice thin layers of skin and leave them here on Galliano, drying on rocks in Montague Harbor. I want to take the peeled bark from an arbutus on Thetis Island, weave it between my fingers, make sea stars. I want to drink salt water. Turn my hair into a new species of kelp. I want to float between trees over the forest floor, smelling cedar, 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 listening to woodpeckers, gray jays, one owl swimming in air. I want never to move out of my body.
You've been listening to Telling Tales, today featuring poet Emily Wall, reading selections from her book, Live Aboard, published by Salmon Poetry. Emily is an assistant professor of English at the University of Alaska Southeast. This program was produced by Jeff Brown in the studios of KTOO-FM in Juneau, Alaska. I'm Ms. G. Thanks for tuning in.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center, information at 789-6780.
Hello, you are listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News, Juno. We have just been listening to Emily Wall's poems. I'm Joan Pardis, your Monday host. Jeff Brown is running the board. And the weather today is mostly cloudy. Isolated showers, highs around 64 tonight. Mostly cloudy, patchy fog late. If you look out the window right now, I would call that mostly sunny in downtown Juneau. Tomorrow, cloudy, chance of rain. Tomorrow night, cloudy, chance of rain. Wednesday, cloudy, chance of rain. And so on and so forth. But it's not raining now. And here in the studio with me today is our first guest of Juno Afternoon, and that's Lori Yorba. She's from FitLore, and she is bringing a Nia Technique Master Instructor to town for a workshop tomorrow night, Tuesday. Hi, Lori. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Joan. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here. So let's start at the very beginning. The event is tomorrow from 5 to 6:30 at the Jack.
At the Jack.
And what is the Nia Technique? So if people are going to go to this class with this Nia Master Trainer, what does that mean?
Well, if you've never done Nia before, maybe you are familiar with the fitness club fitness type classes that we've been doing for years and years. Nia is kind of the new, it's been around for a while. It's kind of like Zumba, but a little bit slower, a little bit more fluid. It's easy to follow, a little less choreography than you would see with Zumba or any more complicated dance or maybe step classes. The music is like a drum beat, very nice and, what do they call it here, soul-stirring. I'll read it. Can I read a little bit of this to you?
Of course.
Okay, so Nia is a sensory-based movement practice that draws from martial arts, dance arts, and healing arts. It empowers people of all shapes and sizes by connecting the body, mind, emotions, and spirit. Classes are taken barefoot to soul-stirring music in 45 countries. Trainings are designed for those seeking personal enrichment and professional development. Every experience can be adapted to individual needs and abilities. No experience necessary. So you can come if you've never been to a fitness class before. You don't need dance experience. Maybe you like to dance. You'd like to get fit and be active using dance. That's what Nia would be really fun for. Maybe you would like to dance. Then it would be very easy to walk into this class and start listening to the music, and your body just starts to move, and the choreography is easy to follow, and they make it fun. It's just it's a fun workout.
Okay, so unlike step or Zumba, it's really simple choreography. So
yes.
It's not like, you know, the fear of, oh, I'm going to fall over my own feet. Or
yes, yeah, trip over,
lines.
I won't be able to follow. No, it's very simple. The songs, for one song, they would probably have about 3 or 4 steps. And then you do those repeatedly over and over again. And then you add a little bit more arms, a little bit more legs, and you kind of let yourself go with the song. Where they'll get you started, and they'll go through the repetitions through the song. But then you see how their arms are moving, but you might want to move your arms a little bit differently because it feels better to you. So it's all that sensory-based type movement.
So it's kind of dance and fitness.
Yes.
And isn't there like a yoga or aspect, or also the Alexander technique? Doesn't it have something to do with that as well?
Well, Nia's more mind-body. So I teach yoga. I'm a yoga instructor. I've taught fitness classes for over 30 years, all different types of classes. But I see this as maybe like a cardio yoga. It's a little bit more in touch with your senses. It's a little slower. You can really think about what you're doing, feel what you're doing. And it's emotional, spiritual. It's just a great, more of a mind. In the whole fitness industry, it's in the mind-body area.
Okay. And if somebody went and studied with this master trainer tomorrow, not studied, but attended the class, okay, it's from 5 to 6:30. There's going to be an introduction. It's open for people who are familiar who are not familiar with the technique.
Right. Anyone. No experience necessary. Just come to move and be active. It's all about fitness. And but tomorrow what she'll do is probably a nice little introduction discussion about Nia, what it is, what to expect. And then she'll do a 55-minute class, which is their base class, and then we'll do a little bit follow-up afterwards. And then if people are interested, I would look to maybe bring a workshop or a training to town in the future. And I plan to get trained so that I could teach here in Juneau. I teach at the Alaska Club. I teach at Mountainside Wellness. If people wanted to see that as a workout, we could bring it to Juneau.
That'd be great. And I know that Nia nationwide has definitely, and probably internationally as well, but I know nationwide that it's really been riding that wave for a long time, that, you know, along with Zumba, I know down south people are taking Nia classes all the time.
That's what I've heard. Members at the club have asked me about it, and then I went to a conference last November, an International Dance and Exercise Association conference, and Nia was one of the workshops there, and I did it, and I thought, this is great. I've done everything there is to do in the fitness world, and I thought, we need to do this next. You just kind of evolve to this type of a workout.
That sounds great. And how much is the workshop tomorrow?
The workshop is $20, and that's for the whole hour and a half, and that goes to cover the fees for the jack, the sound system, the advertising I've had to do, and then there's also a small fee that goes to the instructor. And the instructor, the reason she's in Juneau tomorrow, she happens to be coming up on a cruise ship. And I had sent an email to Nia asking if there was any way we could get something in Juneau. Maybe someone was traveling up here in the summer on vacation. And sure enough, they sent an email out to their faculty, and she came back and said, I'll be in Juneau on July 23rd, and I'd love to do a class. So she's coming in on a cruise ship tomorrow and taking some time from her vacation.
So she's a master trainer. Her name is Shannon Mars, if you want to search on the web to find out who she is. So the $20 gives you an opportunity to really get an introduction in the class by one of the master
trainers
in the country. So that sounds really good. And then if you fall in love with it, Lori might be able to provide.
And if you're still not sure what it's about, if you go to Facebook, if you're a Facebook person, go to Facebook and like my FitLore page, FitLor, and I have videos posted out there of people doing Nia, and the actual creator of Nia is doing a video as well.
Okay.
And if you want to contact me, if you want to contact me, my email address is tlyorba@gci.net, or you can call me at 907-321-0238.
Okay, and then Lori, I just want to ask one more time because
I'm sorry if I didn't.
It's good. So you have an opportunity to take this class, this Nia class with this Nia master trainer. But one more time, is it really open for all shapes and sizes?
Oh yes, because you can move. Well, you know, I don't want to say if you have an injury or something that you probably shouldn't. You know, if knees or something, you shouldn't be doing hard or whatever. We aren't doing a health profile on you. We just have to ask that you know better to come to class. But it's not it's not taxing. You can control or modify for yourself, and the teacher will do that. It's when we teach, when we're trained as fitness instructors, we're all certified, and I'm sure she's certified, she will set the class up for all levels and shapes. It's safe, and we will make it safe for you.
Right, and it also sounds like people are following the beat of their own drum, to just really use a cliche, since you said you were using the drum. So, you know, a lot of people sometimes when they go to a gym class, it's like, oh, well, I have to do what everybody else is doing.
Right.
And it sounds
and
like this
up.
Doesn't really have that kind of box that you have to play inside
no,
of.
No, it's movement for you. They're going to show you what to do, and you're going to follow the instructor, but you don't have to look just like the instructor. You don't have to look like your neighbor. You just kind of let go and do your own move, as big as you want to make it or as small as you want to make it.
And what's great about that is she is a master trainer.
Yes.
So, you know, it's great that we have a wide variety of trainers in this town, and
mm-hmm.
we have a lot of talented people in
yes.
the town. But it's always great to learn from the people that our teachers are learning from.
Yes.
So it's a whole
yes,
different
it's
perspective.
Wonderful. Yes.
So it's just, that's great. So that's tomorrow night, 5 to 6:30 at the Jack, Nia Technique class with a master trainer. It's $20. If you have any questions, you could just go to FitLore on Facebook
mm-hmm.
or give Lori an email at
tlyorba. I'm sorry, tlyorba@gci.net, and you can also go on to the nianow.com website and check out what Nia is all about. There's a lot more information out there.
That'd be great. Okay, thanks, Lori, for coming in today.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 22nd of July, 2013. It's the birthday of American author and columnist Amy Vanderbilt, born in New York City in 1908, cousin of Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt, the railway magnate. She began in journalism at the age of 16 by writing society and feature articles for the Staten Island Advance. And in 1952, she wrote the 700-page Amy Vanderbilt's Complete Book of Etiquette. It sold millions of copies and established her as the foremost authority on the subject. It's also the birthday of the Moravian natural scientist and meteorologist Johann Gregor Mendel, born in Czechoslovakia in 1822. From 1856 to 1863, he performed experiments on 28,000 edible pea plants, and from his observations, he developed his theory of inheritance, including the notion of recombination of genes, which became the basis of the modern science of genetics. It's the birthday, too, of the painter Edward Hopper, born in Nyack, New York in 1882. By the time he was 12, he was already 6 feet tall, skinny, gangly, made fun of by his classmates, painfully shy, and spent much of his time alone drawing. After he finished art school, he went to Paris and spent almost all of his time there alone reading and painting. In Paris, he realized that he had fallen in love with light. He said the light in Paris was unlike anything he'd ever seen, and he tried to recreate it in his paintings. When he came back to New York, he was employed as an illustrator at an ad agency, a job he loathed, and in his spare time, he drove around and painted train stations, luncheonettes, gas stations, and corner saloons. Hopper had sold only one painting by the time he was 40 years old, but his major exhibit in 1933 at the Museum of Modern Art made him instantly famous. Though his work was more realistic and less experimental than most other painters of the time, he painted his scenes in a way that made them seem especially lonely and eerie. Edward Hopper lived and worked in the same walk-up apartment near Washington Square for over 50 years. He ate almost every meal of his adult life in a diner. He never rode in a taxi. He loved the theater, but he always sat in the cheap seats. Edward Hopper, who said, "Maybe I am slightly inhuman. All I ever wanted to do was paint sunlight on the side of a house." And here is a poem by William Matthews titled Another Beer. The first one was for the clock and its one song, which is the song's name. Then a beer for the scars in the table, all healed in the shape of initials. Then a beer for the thirst and its one song we keep forgetting. And a beer for the hands we are keeping to ourselves. The bodies, dogs, they lie by the ashtray and thump suddenly in their sleep. And a beer for our reticence, the true tongue, the one song, the fire made of air. Then a beer for the jukebox. I wish it had the recording of a Marcel Marceau mime performance, 28 minutes of silence, 2 of applause. And a beer for the phone booth. In this confessional, you can sit. You sing it, your one song. And let's have a beer for whoever goes home and sprawls like the remaining sock in the drawer of his bed and repeats the funny joke and pulls it shut and sleeps. And a beer for anyone who can't tell the difference between death and a good cry with its one song. None of us will rest enough. The last beer is always for the road. The road is what the car drinks, traveling on its tongue of light all the way home. Another Beer by William Matthews from his collection Search Party Selected Poems, published by Houghton Mifflin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. And this is Billy Collins, hoping you will join us next time here on the Writer's Almanac.
Hello, thank you for listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. I'm Joan Pardis, your Monday host. Jeff Brown is running the board. And in the studio with me right now is Eric Booklis from the Juno Economic Development Council's STEM program, which is Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. And he is running a couple of camps throughout Southeast this summer. Hi, Eric. Welcome to K2.
Hi, and thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm thrilled to have you. So the STEM program at JEDC, the Juno Economic Development Council, runs a bunch of summer programs for kids, school-age children. And you just came back from Ketchikan where you were running a rocketry camp. Is that true?
Yep, that's right.
And go ahead.
The rocketry camp was for middle school students, and They built a variety of rockets throughout the week. They designed them using computer-aided design software and built some rocket scratch from home recycling. And I think the kids just had a great time building rockets and shooting them off.
Sounds like a blast.
Yeah.
And that was a 4 or 5 day camp?
That was a 5 day camp.
It was a 5 day camp. And coming up next here in Juneau, you have a camp next week, Club Chemistry for 4th and 5th graders. And then the week after that, Kitchen Chemistry. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so this Club Chemistry, I understand Bob Beath was here a couple of weeks ago, and he told me that this was your brainchild. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, so tell us. Eric is currently a UAF college student. He's studying mechanical engineering. He's originally from Canada, but he did most of his education here in Juneau. So let's talk about Club Chemistry. What is it? What will kids be doing?
Well, it's kind of like there's going to be a lot of experimentation. It's a very experiment. The camp is geared toward experimentation. So we're going to be doing chemistry experiments with household materials that the kids can do at home and just a bunch of fun stuff. And, so it's going to be a 4 day camp, and some of the experiments include making green fire and playing with dry ice.
It sounds like Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And also electrocuting a pickle, I have heard.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to be electrocuting pickles and melting the shells off eggs.
Oh, wow.
And just a bunch of cool experiments.
Okay. And you've got to tell them not to do this at home without parental guidance, correct?
Yeah, don't do it without parental guidance.
All right.
I designed most of the experiments so that they could do them at home if they wanted to and show their parents how to do them.
That'd be great. So making really kind of, when you talk about experimentation, yet that here we are, like, you're kind of exposing kids to the whole scientific mind.
Yeah.
You know, how do you learn? How does it work? You have to try this to figure out what's what and so on and so forth. So the camp is open from 4th and 5th graders. It's at Thunder Mountain. It's from 9 to 12:30 next week, July 29 to August 1. Do you have any spots left?
Yes, we have 5 spots left, and you can sign up at stemak.org. And it's like you said, it stems in a branch of the Juneau Economic Development Council. And we're also looking for parent volunteers, and there's also a form you can fill out on the stemak.org website.
And you need them for the chemistry camp and also the kitchen chemistry camp?
Yeah, for the club chemistry camp next week as well as the kitchen chemistry camp the following week.
Okay, so you need volunteers for both classes, both camps. So if there's the parents or someone 21 or older who's a science geek, it's an opportunity to get your geek on, I guess.
Exactly, yeah.
And then there's a few spots left for the club chemistry class. And what I was going to ask, so you're studying mechanical engineering. Were you exposed to a STEM program as a student? Is that how this all started? Or?
I was not. I got introduced to the STEM program through one of my high school classes. Bob actually came in and taught us a little lesson, and I was invited, or I was sent over to his office, and I kind of got amazed just walking through his workshop, and so I asked him if he was looking for any summer interns, and he was. So I've been working with Bob for the past 2 years.
Oh, wow. Well, the workshop that he's talking about is at the Foodland Shopping Center. They have a Saturday thing going on that on Saturdays it's open, and there's some other nights open, too. You could go to the jebc.org website or stemak.org and find out about that. And it's pretty amazing. It's something to be truly wowed by as far as making nightlights and flashlights and soldering and all different types of experiments. Mm-hmm. And Bob's really wonderful with the kids.
Yeah.
So that was 2 years ago that you were introduced to that. And then you're pretty sure that that's the path you want to take at this point?
Yeah.
Okay, so when you talk about mechanical engineering, what kind of career, like, if you could, like, dream it up, what would it be?
It's kind of early for me to tell career-wise, but I know I like building things, and I kind of like fiddling with electronics, too, but mechanical engineering is kind of a more broad degree than electrical, so I just signed up for mechanical since I like the whole idea of engineering and sciences.
Okay. Besides the rocketry camp in Ketchikan and these two chemistry camps, this club chem, which is experimentation, and then kitchen chemistry, which is, what is kitchen chemistry?
Kitchen chemistry takes you through cooking in the household and explains the chemistry behind how cooking food works and through some of the more complex cooking methods and cool experiments that you could do with food.
Wow, you should have an adult version of that. That sounds great. Well, I'd like to sign my husband up for that.
Well, if adults are interested, being a volunteer, you get to experience all the cool experiments and cooking chemistry stuff.
So. Right. And when you talk about a volunteer, are you saying that you want somebody for the whole week or for a couple of hours or for a day? Or
it doesn't matter. If you're willing to help, then contact us, and we'll be glad to have you help us out.
Okay. And that's at stemak.org. And so besides these three camps, are there other camps that you've been involved with this summer?
Yes, I did a geocaching camp in June. And during that camp, kids used GPSs to track and log different geocaches around the Thunder Mountain High School. We went out by Vintage Park and found a geocache over there. And we looked for one in the woods behind Thunder Mountain High School. And we looked for a couple for about an hour, and weren't able to find that one, but I set up a few geocaches throughout the parking lot, and kids had fun kind of searching for the different geocaches.
Right. And the geocaching, do you want to explain, most people know what geocaching is, but do you want to talk about what that is?
It's kind of like a giant treasure hunt where you have a GPS, which you can point log coordinates onto it so that everyone in the world can see where you put a different, like, kind of your treasure so that they can put it into their own GPSs and go out and search for the different geocaches.
Right. And then when you find it, you put little comments in there and notes and so on and so forth. So it really is like an electronic navigation, electronic scavenger hunt, but it's worldwide. So you'd be talking to somebody in Denmark and say, hey, I just found this thing, and so on and so forth. And they're all over Juneau. They're all over Juneau, behind stop signs, all different types of
things. And if you want to do geocaching of your own, just visit the geocaching website. I'm pretty sure it's geocaching.com, or else you could Google it. And they have a whole list of a bunch of geocaches that people have hidden throughout Juneau.
Okay. So besides your interest in sciences, it seems like you also like working with kids.
Yeah.
Okay. As you're working with the kids, you're working with upper elementary and middle school kids. Do you have any stories about the big aha moment where, you know, you see it really happening with the kids?
Yeah. In Ketchikan, for the first few days I was running the camp, I could tell the kids were interested, but it wasn't until, like, Wednesday when I took the kids out for the rocket launch, and I could just see it in their eyes that they were really like starstruck by the whole rocket idea. And then we came back and they were just so excited to build more rockets and to design more. And it was a lot of fun.
Must be pretty cool. So with these camps, have you found, are there more boys, are there more girls? Is it that doesn't even come into play? Or
Well, the geocaching camp was strictly boys, but the rocketry camp was split pretty close down the middle with boys and girls. I'm not really sure the reason to the geocaching camp being filled with boys, but I'm not sure gender plays a huge role in the camps.
Right. I think that gender, that stereotypical idea that girls don't go into the sciences, technology, engineering, and math is pretty much debunked these days.
I agree.
I was just kind of curious if our kids know that it's debunked. All right. Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us. One more time, Club Chemistry is next week, July 29 through August 1. That is the only STEM camp that is not completely filled. And the reason it's not filled, it was a new arrival.
Yep.
Okay. So if you're interested in that, stemak.org, it's open to 4th and 5th grade students in Juneau. It's at Thunder Mountain from 9 to 12:30. And then if you are an adult geek, and I say that affectionately, and you want to volunteer, there's opportunities for club chemistry and also the kitchen chemistry class, which is August 5th through August 9th. Both of these are half days. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, Eric, anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Okay, then we're covered. All right, well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
This is Bird Note. With many migratory songbirds in North America declining at an alarming rate, it's ever more important to map their travels, to learn what they require for food and shelter, when and where. But until recently, it's been impossible to monitor the precise journey of a bird such as the wood thrush. Now, we have tiny, lightweight geolocators. When attached to songbirds, these devices record light levels at sunrise and sunset, marking the bird's exact location. When scientists affixed them to wood thrushes and purple martins in Pennsylvania, the next spring, the returning birds provided new and fascinating information. The geolocators showed that during fall migration, the songbirds rest and feed at specific stopover points in the southwestern U.S. and the Yucatan Peninsula. And in the case of the wood thrushes, they winter in a narrow band of habitat in Honduras and Nicaragua. The geolocators also documented that spring migration is much more rapid than previously thought. One female purple martin flew from the Amazon basin to northern Pennsylvania in 13 days, with 9 days on the wing, an average of over 350 miles a day. Whether spring or fall, we're learning the location of habitats that need to be protected to help the birds survive. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Alaska's holiday favorite, King Island Christmas, is heading over the mountain again, this time in July. There's only one weekend with four performances, July 25th through the 27th, and they're all at the Jack. There's even a pay-as-you-can and a King Island sing-along. Tickets and more information at jahc.org, Hearthside Books, and at the door for King Island Christmas. One weekend, four shows, don't miss it. This message brought to you by King Island Christmas.
Hello, you are listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO News Juno. I am your Monday host, Joan Partis. Jeff Brown is running the board. Thanks for joining us today. This is an abbreviated show today, but next week we will be full, as is the rest of the week, here at KTOO News. So tonight, tune in to listen to Phil Smith on Peace Talk at 7 p.m. this evening. He'll be talking with a member of Veterans for Peace from Florida about a resolution to urge the impeachment of President Obama. The resolution passed a couple of years ago but has not been disseminated, and the Florida members are working to change that at the 2013 Veterans for Peace Annual Convention next month. Tomorrow, Martha Moore hosts Juno Afternoon. She's got a full lineup of great guests, including Christy Sambor, who will give us an update on the Prairie Home Companion, KTOO's 40th anniversary trip. As for weather, tonight, mostly cloudy, chance of rain mainly south of Juno in the evening. Patchy fog late, lows around 51, light winds becoming northeast, 10 miles per hour in the late evening. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, patchy fog in the morning, chance of rain in the afternoon, mainly south of Juno, highs around 65. Northeast wind, 10 miles per hour, shifting to the southeast in the afternoon. Tuesday night, cloudy, chance of rain, lows around 53. Wednesday, rain likely, Wednesday night, cloudy, chance of rain. Thursday, cloudy, chance of rain, and Thursday night through Saturday, mostly cloudy, chance of rain. It's been an amazing summer in Alaska's capital city. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next week, and you are listening to KTOO News Juno.
KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. We're also online at www.ktoo.org.
This question of public sector pensions is not a Detroit issue. It is a issue throughout the United States.
But in Detroit, the question has been called with the city in bankruptcy.
It's Monday, July 22nd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.